We are in Parakeh, we are Pasuk Yud Gimel, and the issue of who volunteered. Who volunteered to go, who did not volunteer to go. And the theme here in this section is the problem of unity among the Shvatim, among the tribes, and how they've sort of gone native. In the sense that they start to look at their neighbors as closer to them than the tribes that are further away, and therefore they're less likely to participate in a war. And that's going to play out. I gave you a table on the sheet, and hopefully that will help. Some of it, you see the question marks on the table. Some of it, it's not quite clear what she's saying, what Devorah is saying, but we're going to do the best we can with it. So, Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13 in Shiras Devorah, right, in Devorah's song. Az Yirad Sarid La'adirim Am. This is right after that line that we talked about, wake up, Devorah, and all that. So after that, we get the line. I think, did we actually cover the preceding Sukkim? No, we did. The archers among the wells and all that. Yeah, we did that. Okay. We did that. So, Az Yirad Sarid La'adirim Am. So, Sarid can mean a couple of different things, but here it means leader. So, a leader descended for the nation. Or leaders descended for the nation. Hashem Yirad Li Bagiborim. And Hashem Yirad Li Bagiborim. Yirad is, as the Da'at Mikra reads it, descended for me among the mighty ones. So what he's saying is, then the leaders among the Jews descended, and Hashem descended among these mighty ones. Mini Ephraim. Mini is like min. Means from. So from Ephraim, Sharsham ba'Amalek, whose roots were among Amalek. Amalek is still very active and involved in the land, and apparently Ephraim is not far from them. So from Ephraim, they came to fight. So Ephraim is good. We're comfortable with Ephraim. Acharecha Binyamin ba'amamecha, and after you Binyamin. So Binyamin came along with Ephraim. Note that if you remember from when we did Yehoshua, they're both central Israel. Right? Binyamin is Yerushalayim points and points north of Yerushalayim on a plain with Ephraim and the part of Menashe that isn't on the other side of the Yarden. They're all together on that one sort of latitude in Israel. So Ephraim came, Binyamin came. Mini machir yordu mechogekim. Mini again means min. So from machir, the mechogekim, the lawgivers literally, but it means the leaders came. So machir is from which Shevet?
Menashe.
Right? Machir is from Menashe. So we have represented here Ephraim, Binyamin, Menashe, and of course all of them are Rachel. Those are Rachel's kids. And now she shifts, talking about Umi Zvulun, from Zvulun, Moshchim B'Shevet Sofer, the ones who are the scribes. They came to fight as well. Actually, I should note, I had it in my notes here, when we talk about Machir, the question is, which of Menashe do we mean here? Machir is usually understood to be Menashe east of the Yarden, the other side of the Yarden, right? If you remember from the Chumash, Machir Nasat Yis HaGilad, I gave Machir the Gilad, which is the land east of the Yarden that Menashe occupied. The problem is that in Pasuk Yud Zayin, in sentence 17, she's going to criticize Gilad, saying Gilad is sitting across the Yarden. So, you know, what do you do with this? So, two answers are offered. Either Radak, who says it means the leaders. The leaders came and the rest of the nation decided to stay put. Because she says here, from Machir Yardu Machokikim, the leaders came. Or alternatively, even though Machir is classically east of the Yarden, nonetheless, this refers to some members of the family who were, in fact, West Menashe.
There aren't two Machirs.
Not that we know of.
No.
So these would be from West Menasha. You know, Menasha that's west of the Yarden. Okay. So these are the good ones. These are the ones we're happy with. They came, their leaders came. Yeah.
The reason they focus on Machir is to get to the... is to explain why Menasha splits up into... They don't say Menasha. The reason they focus on Machir is to indicate that it's people east of the Yarden.
Devorah never mentions Menasha. She calls them Machir here, and she calls them Gilad in Pasuk Yudayin.
Right.
She never uses the word Menasha. Why doesn't she? I would guess only that Machir has become the dominant family.
Right.
And that's sort of where the name has gone. But I don't know. In Pasuk Tezvav, in sentence 15, she talks about Yisachar. We like Yisachar. V'sarai v'yisachar im Devorah, v'yisachar kein Barak, Be'emek Shulach Beraglav. Sarai, not Sarai like, you know, Sarah. My leaders in Yisachar with Devorah, in other words, Yisachar's leaders were with Devorah, and with Yisachar, so Barak, he ran along, I suppose, Shulach Beraglav, was sent forth by foot in the Emek in the valley. So Yisachar is with Devorah. Yisachar is with Barak. Why do we have both? So I brought you on the sheet. No, I didn't. Just kidding. I thought I brought you on the sheet, but it's a Rashi. The Rashi answers that that some of Yisachar is with Devorah and some of Yisachar is with Barak. Specifically, the Sanhedrin from Yisachar is with Devorah. Because remember, Yisachar, we have a tradition. He had scribes, leaders, people who set the calendar based on Pesukim. We have a Pasuk in Divrei Hayamim which talks about how descendants of Yisachar were Yodei Bina Li'itim. They knew times. They knew the calendar. When Yaakov says Yisachar Hamor Garem, that Yisachar is this beast of burden, the donkey, so they understand that to mean that he toils with the burden, specifically in terms of Torah. Yisachar is a scholar. So what we're finding out here is the scholars from Yisachar went with Devorah, and the others from Yisachar went with Barak. That's the way that Rashi takes it. Radak has a different take. Yisachar went with Devorah, and so did Barak. Fine.
When all these tribes are participating, so when it said 10,000 men, is it now 10,000 per tribe, or it's just a few thousand from everybody?
I thought that the initial group, the initial 10,000, came from particular tribes. It was Zebulun and Naphtali, was it? Was the original group? Yeah, Naphtali and Zebulun, Perek Dalet Pasuk Vav.
Okay.
That was the initial group that he brought, and then the others rallied to her.
Okay. Yeah. So we don't know the total number that were actually in the bag.
Correct. The other thing worth noting is that it mentions here Shulach Beraglav, that they came on foot. So we already know they were on foot because we didn't do the chariots. So of course we were on foot. So Rashi says it means they went on missions. They took on missions that they were sent on. Radak says they were so eager they came running on foot. They didn't use their wagons. They just came, you know, as fast as they could. Although I would have thought the wagons would have been faster, but they didn't wait. They raced in. So far, Devorah's in a good mood. Ephraim, Binyamin, Menasha, possibly West Menasha, Zvolun, Yisachar, these are the good ones. Now we have the ones who are in trouble. The end of Pasuk Tet Zayin. Liflagot Reuven, Gedolim Chikrei Lev. So plagot is interpreted as streams. The streams of Reuven, Gedolim Chikrei Lev. They're big in thinking and making decisions. They're pondering. They're investigating. What they're not doing is showing up. And she continues. We're in Parakei Pasuk Tetzayin. Lama Yashavta Bein Hamish Pesayim Vishmoa Shrikos Adarim. Why did you sit between the fences around the pastures? Why did you sit among the pastures to hear the bleating of the flocks? Liflagos Reuven. Ha! Those people from Reuven, the streams of Reuven, Gedolim Chikrei Lev. They're really big thinkers, she says. They're pondering Reuven. They're thinking about it. They're dithering in their tents. So that's the sarcasm of Devorah. She has a very sharp wit. Rashi suggests here that the idea of listening that they're doing, the lishmoa shmikos adarim, isn't listening to the flocks, it's listening to see who's winning the war. You know, and then they'll decide based on that whether they're going to show up or not. They have the finger to the wind. Right, the flocks would be the Jews or something along those lines. But this goes back also, this line, plagot reuvein, goes back to something we said in the beginning of Shoftim, in terms of what happened to Reuven east of the Yarden. I noted for you then, Dat Mikra, in their introduction to Shoftim, contend that Reuven sort of lost their territorial integrity. Meaning, west of the Yarden, you have fairly clear boundaries for the land. The southern boundary is not quite clear, the bottom of Yehuda, but the west is the Mediterranean. And the north, we have some pretty good markers. And the east is, of course, the Yarden. But when you get east of the Yarden, the northern boundary is never really set up. The southern boundary is basically when you hit Ammon and Moab, then you know to stop. The boundaries between the tribes, you know, because there are bodies of water like Nahal Arnon that are mentioned. East of these tribes, it just sort of fades. It just sort of fades. Like you end up in, you know, wilderness, more or less.
The geographic demarcation as far as mountain ranges?
I do not believe so. So what the Dat Mikra claims is that Reuven actually sort of just flowed off into the desert. They moved, shifted away from the Yarden, whereas Gad and Manasseh are pretty solid. Reuven sort of shifts, and they bring a few proofs to it. One piece of evidence they brought when we learned about Eob and Gera was the way that Moab came to attack, and they went north from their territory and crossed the Yarden, and they should have had a problem. Reuven should have been there to stop them. Another piece of evidence they bring is this phrase, plagod Reuven. They suggest it means that his flocks are just sort of streaming off into the Midbar. It's an interesting idea. Whether it's accurate or not, I can't say. I just taught something else where I drew on this idea that they were not intact there. In Shmuel. When Shmuel goes to war, well, unintentionally goes to war against the Plishtim. After Shaul has been coronated, Yonatan kills the local Plishti authority, plunging the Jews into war with the Plishtim. So the Jews at first rally to Shaul, ready to go to war. And then the Plishtim rally in these massive numbers, and the Jews panic. And so they go hide wherever they can possibly find a place to hide. It's a remarkable description. It's in Perkei Gimel in Shmuel Aleph. Yeah, a cave, a hole, a crevice, it's anything. They're going to hide wherever they can. And some of them, it says, flee east to the land of Gad and Manasseh. It doesn't say anything about Reuven. So one of the commentators suggests maybe Reuven lived so close to the Yarden they felt it's not safe there. We want to go further away. Could be. But I wonder if it doesn't support this contention that Reuven actually didn't have that territorial integrity that they had sort of, you know, spread eastward. In any case, the plagot Reuven is not so much the point. The point is she complains that Reuven did not show up, and now we get to that pasuk I already referenced with Gilad. We already said Machir was there, and Machir, we thought, lived in Gilad. But Pasuk Yedzayin says, Gilad be'eber ha'yardain shachin. Gilad lives across the Yarden, meaning staying across the Yarden. Gilad chose not to show up. Vidun, and as far as Dun, lama yugoraniyot, what are they doing on their boats? Meaning, again, not showing up. Asher yashav l'chof yamim, Asher sits by the shore of the seas, v'al mifratzav yishkon, and he rests at his mifratzim. The mifratz is are the cities by the shore, according to the Dat Mikra edition. He says Akko and Sidon, these areas, That's where Asher is. He also suggests that it means they're living among the Canaanim and they don't want to break their deals that they have with the Canaanim. But let's go back to Gilad and what we do with it. So Radak offers two reads, and this is on your sheet, in source number one. He's bothered by our problem. V'halo Machir Omer Shabala Milchama. It said that Machir came to war. U'Machir Avi Gilad. Machir is the father of Gilad, meaning he has a son named Gilad. There it's HaGilad the Beit Machir, and the land called Gilad was settled by Machir. Kamo Shema, Reyitain is HaGilad the Machir B'Menashad, one of several psukim you can bring. V'yesh Lefaresh, he says, you could explain. Kimasha Amar Gilad Be'Ever HaYardin Shachin. When it says Gilad rested on the other side of the Yarden, meaning they didn't show up, Al Beit Yair ben Menashe Amar. That's talking about the house of Yair, son of Menashe. Right? Menashe has Yair as a son, and he has Machir as a son. So Yair stayed. Shigam hu ayachal kovaris ha-Gilad. He also lived in the Gilad. So his first explanation is what we suggested before, which is some of them showed up, some of them did not show up. And that would answer Michael's question about why you called them Machir instead of saying Menashe. The answer is, Machir showed up, Yair stayed home. That would be one approach. V'yesh lefaresh od, or you could explain, Kimash amar Gilad be'ever ha'yardin shachin hu derech tmiha. The other way to do it is to read this as an expression of surprise. When it says Gilad stayed on the east of the Yarden, it's an expression of surprise that translated here as a challenge towards Reuven. V'omer Reuven, saying to Reuven, Lama yashavta b'beisecha v'lo basa l'melchama? Why did you stay home and not come to war? Gilad asa kein kemosha sita ata v'yashav v'shachan be'ever hayardein. Halo chared u'bala azor l'melchamet Yisrael. You know, Gilad was in the same position as you. They lived east of the Yarden, and yet they came to help us. They energized themselves. Ve'ata lama sita kein? So why didn't you show up? So either she's saying Yair stayed home, Machir showed up, or no, they actually did come, and she's using this as a question to Reuven. What happened to you? Why didn't you do it? Done for their part. They're sitting on the boats. Lama Yagurani Yot. Why do you live on the boats? Now, there's a fascinating question which I'm not going to do in depth now because it's going to show up towards the end of Shoftim, and that is the question of where Dan lived. Dan has two portions of land, and at the end of Sefer Shoftim we will find a story where initially they're living west towards the water, but they then move north and conquer a land in Bashan. But that story, according to most commentators, actually took place in the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, before this. Meaning, they've already conquered the land north, in which case they have no business being on boats. So some read this pasuk here, why are you on boats? You live up north. What are you doing on the boat? That's the way that some read this, because it seems like they had moved north before this event took place.
So is Devorah saying that they were on boats because they wanted to avoid the participating in the war?
Exactly. I have bone spurs in my ankle. They are whatever it is, and therefore I can't go to war. I'm sorry. I've got merchandise sitting on boats. I got to go take care of my merchandise. The Rashi and Radak say they put their assets on boats in order to flee. And Asher stays by the sea. Now, I translated the word al-mifratzav yishkon as being port cities. However, Rashi and Radak take it differently. Not Rashi, sorry, Rabag and Abarbanel take it differently. Rabag and Abarbanel say this comes from like the word pirtza. What is it, pirtza?
A breach.
Yes. Exactly. And the idea was that they had areas that were open to the enemy, and they stayed home in order to guard them, and this was actually considered a justified excuse. So that's the reference to the ones who didn't show up. Reuven, Gad, and apparently East Menashe, we think, Dan. Asher may be justified, and that's why I wrote justified on the sheet, if you take this as these breached areas. And then Zibulun, Pasuk Yudchet, we come back to Zibulun. Zibulun am cheref nafsho lamus. Zibulun was daring. They put themselves in a position of life and death danger. The Naphtali al merome sadeh, as did Naphtali at the heights of the fields. They came to fight. They showed up. And then it continues on with Melachim Nelchama, which I'm going to come to in a second. But who's missing from this? We did not represent every Shevet. Shimon is one. Who else?
Yehuda.
Mm-hmm. Shimon and Yehuda. Why are they not here? Not for positive and not for negative.
Are they not in the south?
They are in the south. And therefore?
Couldn't make it, I guess.
One possibility is they're simply too far. Yehuda, remember, Shimon dwells within Yehuda. Yehuda and Shimon are way down south. It's simply too far away.
Weren't the 31 Canaanite kings who came to Sisera's aid blocking the path of anyone to come to assist?
Oh, I thought we read that they were defeated, no? Didn't we make reference to them?
They were defeated, mm-hmm. but this was presumably...
So you think they'd be blocked by them at some... that could be, I suppose. Another suggestion would be, because we don't want to mention that they didn't come help, because this is going to be the recurring theme in Tanakh, is Yehuda versus Yisrael. And you don't want to bring another example of, or another basis for strife between them, to say, look, Yisrael was in trouble and Yehuda didn't show up. So I wonder if that isn't a factor here. Okay. So we have our tribes who helped, and we have our tribes who did not help. And then you get the contrast. Pasuk Yud Tet. Yeah.
Okay. You were able to translate this, except for Reuven, everyone else was a good guy. Because we were able to turn Gilad to Avery and Dan Safay, so it was actually still a criticism.
Right.
You were able to translate it.
No, you weren't.
No, faster.
No. Yeah, Dan does not get saved. Dan does not get redeemed on this. Reuven does not get redeemed on this. And God does not get redeemed. Did we redeem God?
I don't remember.
I put a question mark on the sheet. Where was God? Hang on.
I don't remember. God didn't mention.
Yeah, what did I do here with God? Hang on.
You say it's been 517, but
I did. Oh, I know why. Yeah, because one answer, I skipped the answer from my notes when I was doing it. Some suggest that the reference to Gilad may actually be God.
Right. Okay.
That's the idea. Right. God does not get an explicit mention, but Gilad, as this region, may include God because, you know, Reuben, God, Menashe, they're all together, sort of. God is south of Menashe.
How could Gilad get confused with God?
Not that, but that it's a reference to those who are living east of the Yarden.
Because
that region in the center is called Gilad. Even though we generally identify Gilad as Menashe rather than God. But yeah, that's the possibility, that it may refer to God. Okay. So, contrast the ones who did not show up with Pasuk Yates. Ba'u melachim nilchamu. We come back to those Canaanite kings. The Canaanite kings came and fought. Az nilchamu malchei Canaan. Right? Then the kings of Canaan fought. Bisa'anach almei Megiddo. In Ta'anach by Megiddo. Betza kesef lo lakachu. And they didn't even want payment. They weren't taking payment for it. They just wanted to fight. Interestingly, that Mikra notes, Tanakh and Megiddo are actually far apart. Why are we listing Tanakh on May Megiddo? It's an odd thing. So Rashi says that's the point. It's that the Canaanite forces that came stretched from Tanakh all the way to Megiddo. Let me see if I get anything in the Dot Mikra maps to help us out in identifying the locations that we're talking about. No, he doesn't do it. But they, and the commentators agree that they're far apart. Rashi gives you that that answer, that it's Dafka, the spread of their forces. Radak says they fought specifically in those two places, Tanakh and Megiddo. But either way, the theme that Devorah wants to play up is these kings came on their own. They had no stake in it. They just said, we are volunteering to fight. And not only do they volunteer to fight, but nature volunteered to fight on our side. Pasukhaf. And this goes back to, we read this. We read this in the first, in Perek Dalet, when we looked at the brief description of the war. Min shamayim nochamu, they fought from the heavens. Hakochevim mimisil osam, the stars from their paths in the heavens. Nochamu im Sisra. They fought with Sisra. What do you mean? This is astrology, right? The idea that the stars, the planets, they exert forces on whatever goes on in this world. And so the weather is influenced, and the rain comes as a result of their influence. Nahal Kishon Girafam, the Wadi Kishon swept them away when it became flooded. Nahal Kidumim, the ancient Nahal Kishon, Tidrechi Nafshi Oz. It flowed with great strength, with this flow of water. The Bag Mitzvah David give translations for Tidrechi Nafshi. Either we went through safely, and even with O's, with strength, that's Ralbag, or there hadn't been significant water there before, and so we used to walk through it with strength, and now it's suddenly filled with water, and therefore they couldn't make it through. A couple of notes on this. The statement about the stars. Right, the statement here regarding the stars. So I mentioned astrology as one idea, but there's a medrash that suggests otherwise. Take a look at source number two, the Gemara in Pesachim. There are a couple of versions of this, but here's the Gemara's version. Kevin dinachisu kochvei shamayim alayu, when the stars from the heavens descended upon them, akdiro hani dikri de parzala. Then the weapons that they had, these iron weapons that they had, heated up. And they went to bathe in Nahal Kishon and they got swept away. So the stars heated up the weapons of the soldiers. And that's an explanation. The Dan Mikra suggests, when it says that the stars fought from the heavens, suggests that it's lightning. Which would be really interesting because you already have Barak in the story. But the rivers are certainly understood to be sweeping them away. Okay. So the stars fight. The Malchei Kenan come and fight. I lost the place for where I was. The Pasuk Chav Beis, Sentence 22. Az halmu ikvesus mi daharos daharos abirav. So the hooves of the horses hammered, right? Hey lavad mem is to hammer. The mi daharos daharos abirav, from the flight of their mighty ones, meaning their hooves pounded as they ran away. And then you get this very odd reference. Oru meiroz, Amar Malach Hashem. Aru aror Yosheveha. He says, curse meiroz. So says the Malach of Hashem. Curse those who dwell there. Kilovo leezras Hashem leezras Hashem bagiborim. Because they didn't come to help God. They didn't come to help God among the mighty. So this is a very strange passage. So we're going to make it worse instead of better. There's a Gemara Moed Katan Daf HaZayin which says, Meiroz was either a great figure, some powerful person who did not volunteer to help, or a star that chose to sit this one out. Meaning we talked about the stars fighting, but Meiroz did not descend to get involved. To which you have to ask, what are the residents of Meiroz then? What does that mean? You're the residents of Meiroz. So some
say, well, I have a problem with that. If God commanded the stars to take action, how can you have a star that doesn't take action?
What do you mean?
Well, the explanation was that the stars got involved in the battle.
Yes.
So how can one star not get involved?
Well, let me go back a step. You're assuming that the stars that did get involved were commanded by Hashem to get involved.
Well, how else did it happen?
Okay. It's a good question, but what's the answer? What do we mean when we talk about the stars doing anything?
Lining.
Sorry?
The stars?
Yeah.
Lining, like in certain...
No, but what do we mean when we talk about stars doing anything? What we mean, it has to be some form of association of a malach with these celestial entities. There's some kind of malach that's involved, and the malach chose to get involved or chose not to get involved. I think you have to read it that way. There are stories in the Gemara from time to time in which a person has a dialogue with natural entities. Example is the classic story of Elazar ben Dordaya, who had sinned in a bunch of different ways, and then he decided he's going to do tshuva, and he calls out to the mountains and says, "Mountains, help me do tshuva." And the mountains say, "Sorry, we got our own issues that we had to take care of." And the rivers also, and they say, "Sorry, we're busy too." And Tosfos asks, "Are you serious?" He had a conversation with the mountains. He says, "No." The answer is he's appealing to malachim that are associated with them for help. And the malachim are saying, "You've got to do this tshuva yourself. You can't, rely on us to do tshuva for you." So that's the way I would read Devorah's poem, recognizing that fundamentally it's a poem. At the end of the day, you have to allow for the fact that this is poetry. But Radak in number three chooses to read Meiros the way that I would have read it as just Pshat, which is it's a city. That didn't help.
Well, if it's poetry, she's taking her time to challenge everyone. The first half of the poem is praise and rebuke. So, but this is going off in a different direction altogether.
Well, is it?
Well, they're real, they're identifiable forces.
Yes.
But this is... this is comparing celestial... This is getting involved with celestial forces.
Yes.
That we can't identify.
But I don't think it's actually a different part of the poem. I think that you will... I'm going to explain shortly, but I think all of this is on one theme. She's pushing one point and just doing it, in a poetic way. Let's just see the Radak in number three about Meiros. He says, Shem ir krova lemakom hamilchama. It's the name of a city close to the site of the battle. Velo ba'u le'ezra l'ficha kilos. And they didn't come to help, and therefore she cursed them. Aval harachokim shlo ba'lo kilosam. She's not going to curse all the people from far away, but you guys were right here. You could have helped us. I don't know whether Meiros is Jewish or not Jewish. Rabbi Nel says they're Jewish. So I don't know why they're not included among the Shvatim. Unless they're part of a Sheva that did help, but they personally did not help. That part I can't really figure. But she has now identified for us, after her initial part, right, after the beginning of the poem, which we saw last week, where she emphasized the importance of thanking Hashem and the wonders of what happened. We were stuck, we were trapped, we were up in the mountains, we couldn't travel, and Hashem has now helped us. She's gone through who came to assist. Thumbs up for you. Those who did not, thumbs down for them. And then she says, from the stars they fought. And the Malchei Canaan fought. And Meiros did not help. Bad Meiros. And then she goes into Yael. So once we see Yael, everything else I think is going to fall into place in terms of what she's trying to do. But maybe I'll explain it already here because you pointed out and asked the question. So I'll mention it here. And you'll see it play out with Yael. The theme for Devorah is the volunteering theme. She wants people to get up and act on behalf of Hashem and on behalf of the Jews. Go back to the beginning of the story. How did this whole story start?
They're calling again for Barak.
Exactly, right? Barak was supposed to be the one to lead them to fight. She said, we have a message from Hashem. She says, hello, hasn't there been a message from God saying you're supposed to do this? You're not willing to go. This is her theme. In her era, this is what she wants to push and to promote as the leader, is people have to get up and do. You can't rely on somebody else to get the job done. You can't look after your own affairs. You have to be willing to step up on behalf of the nation. That's Devorah's theme. And she says, look, the Canaanim came, and they didn't even want any money. Right? How could you not support us in the battle when all the Canaanim are sticking together? That's her angle. And that's why Yael, especially if she's not Jewish, is such a great player in this. Because she didn't have a horse in this race. Right? She chose to get involved. And so that's where she turns. Tevorach minashim Yael eshes chevra keni, pasuk chav dalet. That tevorach minashim is a problem. Those words are a problem for translation. A few people here have translations. Take a look, please, at the opening two words in Pasuk Chav Dalet in sentence 24. Fred, you have an art scroll. How does it translate the opening words?
It just says, blessed by women is Yael.
You got it. Blessed by women is Yael. The Pink Book, the Judaica Press, what do you have?
Blessed above women.
Blessed above women is Yael. Okay, what do you have? That's Sansina. Blessed above or blessed by?
Blessed above.
Blessed above? There's no English in that. That's not English. No. Okay, you've got the Pink Book. Yeah. Okay, and Corinne has?
Same. More than women.
Blessed, okay, above, more than. Okay, you understand.
My Yiddish.
Yes, we don't have. Luke couldn't make it tonight. We don't have the Yiddish one. But let me ask you a question. Why is one of them reading it blessed by and one of them is reading it blessed more than? Why is that? It's the mem.
The mem, yeah.
It's the mem. The letter mem is a very agile prefix. It can do different things. And not only the two that you've heard here. Tevorach minashim, she should be blessed by the women, is a legitimate read. Then that's actually a Barbanel's read. But she can be blessed minashim more than the women of the ten, is also a legitimate read, and that's Ralbag. However, there are two more possible reads. First of all, there's another read of, actually, first of all, Rashi also says by the women of the tent. It's not just the Barbanel, it's also Rashi. But in two different ways. Rashi and the Barbanel are going to differ as to how to read it when you say she's praised by the women of the tent. And then another read also brought with Rashi by Rashi is she is blessed among the women of the tent. Tevorach minashim. Minashim, from among the women. Meaning the women of the tent in general are blessed, and Yael is one of the women of the tent. See, part of the question is, what tent are you talking about? Right? Because the pasuk just says, minashim ba'ohel tevorach, but who are nashim ba'ohel, and what kind of an ohel are you talking about? So let me walk you through four different approaches. First of all, take a look on your sheet at Rashi in source number 4. Rashi, as I said, brings you two explanations. Either it's by the women of the tent or among the women of the tent. He says, first of all, Hein yoldu vayigdalu, they birth children and raise them. V'im lo Yael, hare harasha zeh ba'um abdan, if not for Yael, this wicked one would have destroyed them. And he says that's what's found in the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah. So in other words, the women of the tent could be a reference to either random Jewish women or Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, whose descendants were in danger, and she saved them. So therefore, the women of the tent are going to bless her. That's one approach in Rashi.
Is there any reference to them being women of the tent generally?
Well, when you think about the beginning of this week's Parsha, right? Sarah is in the Ohel. Rivka is in the Ohel when she overhears what Yitzchak is trying to do with the bracha for Esav. Ohel Rachel and Ohel Leah, we know they had their own tents, and various stories involve those tents. The business with the Trafim and and of course the whole confusion about the Duda. They all had the Ohel. And of course, we talk about Sarah's Ohel in particular as a parallel to the Beis HaMikdash, right? The three miracles of Sarah's Ohel. The candles don't go out from Shabbos to Shabbos, right? Like the menorah that burns all the time in the Beis HaMikdash.
Doesn't Yitzchak take Rivka
to the tent of Sarah? But that's exactly it. That's where that comes from, is because the fact that he brings her to the Ohel, and that's when he has Nechama, that's when he has consolation. because he sees that the miracles of his mother are renewed. That's where Rashi brings it. But it's the menorah. It's that her bread never became stale, just like the lechem upon him in the Beis HaMikdash. And it's that there's an anan overhead, like the anan, the cloud of Hashem, that's manifest in the Mishkan. They are associated specifically with the Ohel. But Rashi brings a second approach, which is more pshat, davar acher, alternatively. Av Ya'el haita yoshevet ohalim. Ya'el was a dweller in tents, right? We saw that. So it mentions her with the bracha of tents, meaning she is blessed among the women of the tents. She's a woman of the tent too. Abarbanel, though, goes back to read it as she is praised by the women of the tent, but in a very different read. He says, Lafisha nashim hatsnuod ba'ohel, ulai yechrea pam ala pa'ala zesha astayael. He says, the women who are tsanua, the women who are private in the tent, might look askance at what Yael did. You invited this man into your tent? And especially when we know, because we have already referenced it, the way that Dvorah is going to describe this story with the assault of Yael, like, they're going to look at this and say, this is inappropriate. Ulkach tzivta, so Dvorah instructs, Shaloi kaluosa, v'loi ganua. They can't curse her, they can't mock her. V'loyo rushu masach zari. They can't say that what she did was cruel. You stab this guy with a tent peg. The aval yivarchu, just the opposite. They should bless her. So she should be blessed. Devorah's ordering. She should be blessed by the women of the tent. And then the last read is Ralbag, and Ralbag says she's praised more than the women of the tent, and Devorah is positioning herself as a woman of the tent. If you look at source number 6, Omnam Ya'el tia brucha, Ya'el should be blessed, ki azra lehem barigat Sisra, she helped them in killing Sisra, v'yoser minashim shein ba'ol tevarach, she should be blessed more than the women who are in the tent.
So where is Devorah here?
Just that she is. Devorah is one of them. That's all. Yeah. Okay. So then we get the story. First we introduced it with, she deserves a great big bracha, right, for what she did. And again, all these different angles on that. Mayim sha'al, he asked for milk, for water. Chalav nasana, and she gave him milk. B'seifel adirim hikriva chem'ah. In the trough of mighty ones, this great big trough, she brought him cream. And the idea is that, again, this is something that's very rich, and we talked about the idea that this would put him to sleep, which is what most commentators assume. When I taught this class for the women, one of the women pointed out, we also read that she covered him with a blanket. So covering him with a blanket and giving him milk is this very maternal image, which speaks to the whole story, which has been the story of the women, in terms of Devorah, in terms of Yael, and then in the end with the mother of Sisera. The Jewish mother is both maternal and a threat. That's the message. So I didn't make that up. That's just what it says. The Pasuk Chavav, sentence 26. Yada layaseid tishlachna. She sent her hand for the spike. Vimina, her right hand, lahalmus amelim, for the hammer, halmus, like helem that we had before, of the workers. The halmas Sisra, and then she hammered Sisra. Machakaro shows she smashed his head. Umachatza v'chalfaraka. So she smashed his skull. She killed Sisra. Okay. And then the next pasuk, which, again, it's hard to figure out how to read this pasuk. Bein ragleha kara nafal shachav. You could read it as between her legs, you could read it as at her feet. He kneeled, he fell, he lay down. Bein ragleha kara nafal, she repeats it. Basher kara, where he kneeled, sham nafal shadud, there he fell, despoiled or destroyed. So the mafarshim, the commentators, have a problem here. The problem really has to start with the order of the psukim. If you're going to tell me that this is a rape, then the pasuk is in the wrong place, right?
Yeah.
She already killed him in the previous pasuk. Right? This pasuk, if that were really describing that, should have been pasuk chavav. Should have been number 26. is out of order, if that's really what's happening. Nonetheless, I brought you the Gemara in source number 7. Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak described this as an example of Avera Lishma. It's a transgression, what she does with him. But it's Lishma, it's for the sake of heaven. And he says, it's even greater than doing a mitzvah, Shalom Lishma. To which the Gemara says, what are you talking about? Mitzvahs Shalom Lishma, mitzvahs that are not for the sake of heaven, are still extremely valuable. Alright, fine, they're on the same level. A sin that's Lishma is on the same level as a mitzvah that's Shalom Lishma. As we see from the fact that she is blessed for what she did, and there you see the Sar Rivka Rachaleya reference in the Gemara there in number 7. And it goes on to say, based on the verbs in the pasuk, that that this happened 7 times that he did this with her.
Is this implying that this was either her initiative?
Yes. Yeah, that she initiated it. The Mefarshim, though, the commentators are really troubled by this. And like I said, I think one reason they're troubled is just because the pasuk is in the wrong place. It's much cleaner as a read if this is just describing how he collapsed. But take a look at source number 8, Medrash in Vayikra Rabba, where Reish Lakish says also, absolutely not. Three people fled from sinning, and God joined his name with them. And these are the three: Yosef, Yael, and Palti. Right? Yosef with Potiphar's wife, Palti ben Laish with the daughter of Shaul, who was really supposed to be married to David, and Yael is in the mix there. Yael minayin. How do we know this for Yael? Because it says, Vateitza Yael likras Yisra, Yael went up to greet him, Vatechaseu basmicha, she covered him with a smicha. Mau basmicha, what does the word basmicha mean? It's an odd word. Rabbanan dahacha amri bisudra. So the rabbis in Israel said, it means with a cloth. Rabbanan de Taman, the rabbis there said, bimeshichla, with a tub of some kind. That's what a smicha is. And Reish Lakish says, Chazayin wakala mikra v'lomatsinu kli shishmo smicha. We don't know this word smicha that you're talking about. We don't know what kind of an implement you're referring to here. Rather, ma'u smicha, what does smicha mean? Shmi ko. My name, and it's God speaking, so it's capital, my name, is here. Shmi me'id alash lo naga ba'osa rasha. I testify that this guy never touched it. Reish Lakish cannot believe that anything actually happened. He just can't believe it. Reminiscent of the Judith story, which we've connected to this before, in which also he drinks himself to intoxication, Holofernes, but nothing ever happens between him and Judith. Again, we talked about the modeling of the Judith story on this story. The two would go together. There was an article in the 30th volume of the journal Truman. I gave you a link to it in number 9. It came out a bunch of years ago. It's now they're up to 38 or 39 now, I forget. So it was 8 or 9 years ago. It's an annual. In which Rabbi Ari Shavat argued that this may be used as a precedent for what's called the honeypot strategy. In which a woman poses, as something, whatever, as part of espionage, and lets herself be used by the enemy in order to get the information that she needs. And the question is that halachically permissible? And so he argued for using this Gemara about Yael he argued about whether you could use this Gemara about Yael as a precedent. He also brought in Esther and Achashverosh as a model for it. It was a very controversial article when it came out. It caused quite a fuss. So, yeah.
He feels the need to find evidence for her not having...
Reish Lakish, yeah.
But it begs the question whether he's genuine when he says... I'm looking at the English, so it could be a misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. If somebody takes all this time to say it never happened, you wonder why he's read anything into it in the first place.
Well, because he knows the Gemara. Right? The Gemara said it happened.
Oh, right. I thought he was responding to the text.
No, he's responding to Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak, and especially when you look at the names involved. In the Gemara number 7, the last one to speak is Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish are sparring partners. They dispute all the time. So Rish Lakish knows that Rabbi Yochanan says, not only did it happen, but it happened seven times, and Rish Lakish says, not even once. That's the back and forth. Now,
I just wanted to say that physically, if you want to hold the ball really well so you can stab it, you might support it with your legs.
Mm.
You might be kneeling on your knees holding the ball.
Yeah.
It could be that that's what she did.
Right. Right. Could well be. Could well be.
But you
might want to try just to figure out like how this works.
Like in a headlock or something.
Isn't Sue saying that his head fell in that position? Being Riblet had
Haranafal should do it. Well, the problem is if he's asleep, he's not up in order to fall. He's on the ground.
Right.
So I don't really know. I mean, I would not have read Nafal as to fall. I would have read Nafal, he lay there dead. You know, he was defeated, if you will. That's why I would have read the word Nafal. The Netziv has an interesting discussion on this concept of Avera Lishma, which is worth noting, you know, as you read this, when you have a Gemara praising Avera Lishma. And the Netziv, I didn't bring it here, it's on the end of Parsha Shlach, Veloz Asurach Elevavchem. He says, Avera Lishma was the way many Jews served God before we had a Torah. And it was the right way to do it. Meaning, before Hashem gives you laws, so you do the best you can to figure out what it is that the situation demands of you. Your intention is for God. And it could be that what you're doing is going to break laws that are going to be on the books when the Torah is given. But right now, this is what you have. When you get to Parsha Shlach, which at the end of Parsha Shlach is the Parsha of the Tzitzis, you read, "Velo sasuru achrei levavchem v'achrei nechem." Do not stray after your heart. Do not stray after your eyes. So he says, "Do not stray after your heart" means even if your heart tells you this is the right thing to do, if the mitzvos say this is the wrong thing to do, then you don't do it. That's when avera lishma becomes prohibited. You have to follow the mitzvahs you've been given instead. Yeah.
This is clearly after the Torah was given.
Correct. So what he says as far as Yael, and he applies it as well to Tamar, Yehuda and Tamar, is that they had no other option. Yael, what else was Yael supposed to do? Assuming that this is what happened, it was what happened because it was necessary.
Also, we're saying the end justifies the means when we're saying the
relationship. Exactly, which is why it's such a dangerous thing to say.
Yeah.
That's why it's so dangerous, because it can be absolutely misused.
Isn't this pikuach nefesh? In other words, not end justifies the means, but it's pikuach nefesh. She's
for whom?
This Jewish lives. The bracha you're saying is because she saves these unborn children and everything else with her action.
So clearly that motivates her. I mean, if I wanted to argue against her, I would say, but his army was routed. He's done.
Does she know that?
I don't know. But if I wanted to make the argument against, that's the argument I would make. But Yael is presented here, you know, clearly as a heroine, whatever it was that happens in this story and how this plays out. And again, it plays into the theme of those who volunteer. The last part of the parak is the business of Sisera's mother. So we're not going to get through all of it, but let's at least see the psukim. Pasuk Chavchet, 10:28. Be'ad hachalon nishkefa batiyabev eim Sisera be'ad ha'eshnav. Out the window, the mother of Sisera looks out, and batiyabev, the famous word, yevava, she wails. The Gemara uses that as an analog for shofar, which we'll have to talk about next week. But she's looking out through the eshnav. Eshnav is an interesting word. I want to come back to it after we finish the pasuk. Madua boshesh richbo lavo. Why is it that his chariot is late in returning? Boshesh, like boshesh Moshe l'reda minahar. He's late. I expected him, and he's not here. Why is he taking a long time? Madua echaru pa'amei markvosav. Why are the hoofbeats of his chariots delayed? Sister should have been back by now. So the word eshnav is a very interesting word here. The Dat Mikra, in number 10, I brought it for you, from Professor Eli Tzur, says, this is an attempt to contrast Yael's tent with Sisera's mother's tent. And therefore, to contrast, really, the luxurious lifestyle of the Knanim with those of the people living there in Israel. Ohel Yael al-Kelav ha-Chavatzav ha-Pshutim. The tent of Yael has these very simple implements. Yateru makevet, a spike, and a hammer, obviously. Mayim v'chalav, it's a good thing. Mayim v'chalav, water, milk. Huhi puchosho beis Sisera b'charoshes hagoyim. That's the opposite of Sisera's house back in Charoshet Hagoyim. Sheba'ar chalona eshnava. Mashkifa givira, the matron of the house looks out of this eshnav window, mukefet matroni tot, and she's surrounded by matrons. How do we know they're matrons? Because you'll see the nashim and that are there. Asher liban l'silsulei levush v'lishfachot mekushatot, and their hearts are for, I translated, frippery. Silsulei levush. I thought that was a really nice translation. It means kind of decorative clothing, and made up maidens. And he says, you want to know what an eshnav is, just in the interest of time, I'm going to read my English. It will be appropriate to note here that the eshnav seems to be a layer of decorative stone inlaid in a window. And it's one of the identifying signs of royal palaces and nobles as seen in archaeological finds in the palace of Ramat Rachel in South Jerusalem. That's a very interesting site, the Ramat Rachel site, because there they also used archaeobotany. I'm just saying this, I like using that term, archaeobotany. They peeled off layers of plaster on the buildings there. This goes back to the first Beis HaMikdash time. And they found pollen underneath, just embedded in the plaster. And they found that three out of the four species of the Arba Minim were there in it, based on analysis of the pollen.
This
very cool stuff. I don't know where it is. I just know it's Ramat Rachel. That's what I know. But the image here is the luxury that they have. That's the way that Mikra reads it. What we'll start with next time, God willing, is Rabbi Yosef Albo in the Sefer Ikarim, who has a different take about what the Eshnav is. So we'll have to start with that, God willing, next week. Sure.